Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
Hello, my name is Robin Wigglesworth. I'm a journalist with the Financial Times, but I'm glad to say that Simon has reluctantly relinquished his normal seat for a few episodes to allow me to dig into one of my favorite subjects, quantitative investing, and how it's reshaping asset management and markets more broadly. I'm glad to have another excellent guest with me today, Russell Korgamkar, the Chief Investment Officer of Man AHL. He first joined Man in 2001 as a researcher focused on systematic cash equity strategies. He then became a portfolio manager there, head of portfolio management in 2011, and later director of investment strategies, and ultimately overall CIO of Man AHL in 2020. Hi, Russell. Thanks so much for being here today.
Hi, Robin. Thank you very much for having me.
Man Group initially started out as a sugar brokerage back in 1783, but today it's one of the biggest hedge fund groups in the world, with nearly $150 billion worth of assets under management. AHL is one of the quantitative systematic sides of the business and manages about $57 billion. Now, Russell, obviously I did a bit of digging into your background, and like a lot of quants, you have a background from the sciences, specifically physics, with a first-class degree from Oxford. But your favourite asset class, and I probably agree with you, is something a bit more artisanal, fine wines, I gather. And like one of our other guests, you are also a bit of a petrol head and follow Formula One, something we don't share, sadly. I seem to be the only plus 40-year-old in the world that still doesn't have a driving licence. As sad as it is to say, not many people dream of becoming a quantitative investor when they're young. How did you end up doing what you're doing?
I dreamt of many things. I think I ran the full gamut of potential careers when I was growing up. Footballer, I thought that could be a good career. It's a team sport, high octane. I thought I could be a professional golfer because you can have quite a long career and get to travel the world. Formula One driver, instant feedback as a career and high adrenaline. The challenge was I totally lacked any talent for any of those things. But I do remember a friend of mine, when I must have been about 10 or 11, I got a lift with him, and his dad had this car with one of those big telephones in it, which at the time was really cool. And he was an investment banker. So I went through a period of wanting to be an investment banker for about a week. And I have to say, as these things turn out, I'm pretty glad that I became a quant investor and not an investment banker.
Yes, I think that probably was a better career choice. Why not physics then? Why did you study physics and why not become a physicist? I have to admit, it was what I was dreamt of being when I was younger, until I realized I'd be nothing more than a mediocre one. And that sounded pretty sad.
I did think about it. I met three professors considering applying for a PhD under them. they all worked in underground basements without any windows, and none of them were particularly inspiring. So I thought, rather than do another 3 or 4 years of this, why don't I see what's out there in the world? And I had no knowledge of quantitative investing at that time. And I hadn't spent ages, as people do in their second year at uni, planning out their career for the next decade. I kind of stumbled into the entire thing. The entire thing is just a series of events that have happened without much planning. I was doing a job for the treasury team, just a temp job, filling in time. I had some time out after my degree and I was considering what to do. So I took this temporary job. It was in the treasury department of Man Group. The lady who was, I guess, the head of the treasury department at the time looked at my CV, decent academic qualifications. She said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I don't really know yet. I'm going to try to figure it out." And she said, "Well, why don't you speak to the guys downstairs on the fifth floor? I have no idea what they do. They're all geeks. You might fit in down there." So I went down the fifth floor. They said, "Do you code?" Not really. I did a little bit during my physics course. And they said, "Okay, well, you've got 2 weeks to learn. If you do a good enough job, we'll keep you on." Clearly, I've made the grade just about, and I'm still here.
Yeah. Well, it seems to have worked out reasonably well for both you and NHL. Just on returning to the Formula One issue, I can't get that out of my head. I thought all quants just played chess and go. They weren't petrol heads. I get that there is a physics angle to it, but isn't that what you guys all do? Code and play go?
There's this kind of classic image of the quant that's just into reading maths book or doing kind of physics problems or playing chess or Dungeons and Dragons or something like that. I would say I'm a relatively rounded geek as opposed to a hardcore geek. I've got a bit of a fuller range of hobbies, I suppose.
Quantitative investing is also itself a fairly broad discipline. It's a broad church. I'd love to hear how you see Man Group fitting into this overall spectrum. What does make Man tick and how is it different from some of the other firms that people might have heard about?
Within Man itself, it's a fairly broad church. So Man has different, we call them content engines, other people will call them investment managers, I suppose, which have different specialties. And our specialty is systematic macro trading. And that by itself, by the way, is an incredibly broad church. You've got a broad church within what's an extremely broad church. Within AHL, even with regards to the kinds of strategies that we run, it's become much more broad and diversified over the years. We started in the late 80s as a trend follower, and that strategy took AHL, I would say, pretty much up until the financial crisis. It evolved, new signals came in, etc. But by and large, it was a trend follower for most of the first 20 years of its existence. And post the financial crisis, it became pretty clear to us and to everyone else that you couldn't really get away with just doing trend following. The returns weren't quite good enough. And we felt as a business, it wasn't quite solid enough either, in that people have short time spans. And if they're invested in a strategy that doesn't work for 6 months, they start to get restless. And if it doesn't work for a year or 2 years, then they pull their money out. So we felt that we needed to diversify from a business perspective, but we also felt just from a returns perspective and what we could do for clients, we could start to take the knowledge and skill sets and apply them in different areas. That meant not just trend following, but it meant other styles of strategies. It meant other markets. And we took this philosophy, which did one of three things. It's either you add new markets to trading systems that you know, or you add new models to markets that you know, or you change the models that you currently run. And we found that it was pretty much in that order. Number one was adding markets. Diversify across markets as much as you possibly can. The second was adding models. And then the third was changing existing ones. And we tried to do that as little as possible. As things stand now, AHL, as you said, is 57 billion at the last reporting date, of which it splits about a third in long-only risk-managed strategies, about a third in what we would call liquid directional strategies, and about a third in hedge funds. It's diversified from a business perspective. And under the hood, there are close to 100 different strategies and probably 1,000 different signals that go into them. So it becomes very, very diversified.
One thing I've heard consistently from the quant industry is that stuff that used to print money 10, 20, 30 years ago, like trend following, was just did incredibly well for so long. And some of this stuff still works, but it just doesn't work nearly to the same extent. This alpha decay, I think, is a fascinating concept. How quickly does alpha decay now, and how do you deal with it?
I think it's correct to talk about alpha decay. I remember when I started, I recognized pretty quickly that what this was doing was exploiting inefficiencies. I was running a systematic stat arb strategy back then, and you could look at the back test, the account curve, which started with a Sharpe ratio of about 10 or something in the 70s and 80s, then slowly decayed and decayed and decayed until you got to, back then was the late 90s, early 2000s, and it got to a Sharpe of about 1.5. And I thought to myself, look, this is just, you know, efficiency of markets in action. And I'm not really going to have a very long career in this place because it's all going to be priced in quickly enough. And here we are 20 years later, and we're still talking about alpha decay. And so it's become more difficult to find an edge in markets, and it's become more difficult to maintain an edge. You need to constantly innovate. What you can't do anymore, but certainly not at scale, is find a strategy and then just sit on it for 20 years. From our perspective, as I always say to the team here, don't get excited when you have a good year, because it's not really your work delivered the good year necessarily. It's what was done in the last 5 years plus. And you're constantly building for the future. So you constantly need to find new sources of alpha. You need to recognize when alpha disappears. You need to recognize when markets themselves evolve and certain things don't work anymore. I would say from a how do you think about it perspective, the bar is constantly increasing, and therefore the amount of work that you do necessary to stay ahead just keeps going up.
So is this what a lot of people get wrong about quant investing, that they think it's a big supercomputer sitting somewhere that just generates lots of money, you can go to the beach and relax? There's a depressing amount of hard work involved as well.
It's a lot of work, that's for sure. It's a lot of finding data sets, knowing where to look, understanding how the markets are evolving, understanding the dynamics of markets, how they react to certain events and inefficiencies that might exist. Much like discretionary trading, you need to have an instinct. How do these relationships work? And how does one variable explain another market's returns and so on? Just to come back to your supercomputer analogy, we do actually have teams that look at it from that perspective as well. There's two ways you can approach researching and systematic trading. Either you have an idea about how markets work and you use data to test your hypothesis, or you use the data without an idea. And you say, the data tells me this, and therefore I'm going to build a trading strategy. I think that second version is much harder to get right, but it doesn't mean that we're not trying. And these days, you just have more opportunity, you have much more data, and your processing power is quicker. You have more chance to find an edge in that approach.
The two kind of main philosophical divides I've noticed inside Quantland, though obviously it's a fairly broad church, tends to be on two of these points. You know, to what extent you tinker with the model when it doesn't work, or you believe that actually you have to have faith in it. Humans do all sorts of stupid things, and don't try to get too cute or too discretionary. We're systematic, stick to the model. And then other people say, no, you have to override it all the time because, you know, markets are inherently quite dynamic and they change all the time. Like, we didn't have a global pandemic in the data set, so you do need to interfere. And on the other point, to what extent will you use signals that make no intuitive sense? That a lot of quants I know, they want to have some economic rationale. They might have discovered it through a bit of, let's be frank, data mining, but they want it to have some economic rationale for them to feel comfortable systematically mining it. But other people say, well, actually, the most profitable signals might just seem dumb, but they work. And fundamentally, if they seem to work well enough with a high enough sort of statistical strength, then why not use it? Where do you and Man Group and Man HL sit in these two debates?
I think actually it's possible for those approaches to coexist to a degree. The first camp who say, we're never going to step in and we're never going to touch our models. That might be possible, but you need to set your models up in a certain way that that's the case. So they need to be very self-correcting. They need to have lots of risk management built into them. And then you can get to the place where the models themselves know when the market's getting stressed, they reduce their positions or close down trading altogether. In which case you can probably say, I'm going to run a pretty much a completely systematic approach. And then you get other models that for whatever reason, they haven't seen that environment before. Their risk management wasn't as designed to deal with particular stress environments. And the managers will think, look, I need to step in. And they would be right to step in for that kind of model. And the people who say they shouldn't step in running a different type of model would be right as well. And in a way, it's similar for research as well, insofar as if you were to ask me, which I thought was more likely to work. It's certainly more likely when you have an intuition as to why a particular feature of the market that seems predictable. But that's not to say that I would completely rule out the other approach. When it seems to me actually perfectly reasonable to these days have fairly advanced systems that can replace human beings in an intuitive way, like self-driving cars, for example, that's a very complex environment in which a machine learning process is able to navigate a complex environment in a very, very effective and safe way. Is it therefore reasonable to suggest that a trading system could navigate the complexities of a market in a sensible and profitable way as well? We're open to it, but I have to say that the barrier to entry is higher. It's more difficult to convince people that that's a genuine signal and not data mined. And in order to do that, you just need time. Try these things out in live trading, and do they work, and they look sensible? And if so, and you put a whole load of those things together, then you can be in business.
One of those kind of weird signals that I remember hearing about was Jim Simons at Renaissance Technologies. He famously said that they used to buy French stocks when the sun was shining, because literally French traders were far more optimistic than anywhere else in the world when the sun was shining in Paris. Now, you have an economic rationale for it, even though it's completely insane. But they said it worked. And obviously, the reason why I told people about it is clearly it doesn't work anymore. And it made me thinking that, are the opportunities potentially greater in those less obvious areas? But also, how do you know when that stops working? When do you say that alpha decay, or the alpha has decayed or disappeared? Or when do you say, well, actually, this is just a temporary thing? Because not everything works equally well every day, week after week, year after year.
It helps to have an idea of why the alpha should work in the first place. You can run various tests to understand the sensitivity of the alpha to certain macro variables or the macro environment, which can give you a clue if you say, well, this kind of signal, it might not be explicitly related to changes in interest rates, but it seems to work more or less when there's a rate declining environment and not so well in the other environment. And that can maybe give you a bit more of a guided guess as to why the things stop working. The problem with the we'll never switch it off approach, because it might work, is the type one versus type two error problem. And the type one being that it actually works and you switch it off just because it happened to have gone through a bad period, but that was just bad luck. Or the type two error being it's actually genuinely stopped working. And if you don't turn it off, it causes a nasty drawdown and a big negative contribution to the portfolio. For us, we'd be a bit careful of type two errors. It's okay to have the odd type one where you switch something off prematurely, as long as you have a broad enough research process developing lots of these signals. And the benefit that we have in systematic, of course, is even if you switch it off, you can still track how the thing would have done.
What's your favorite example of something, a signal or a strategy that used to work maybe at the start of your career, but now obviously has completely disappeared? I'm not asking for the secret sauce, but something like really weird or fun or interesting that used to be a money printer, but now it's just a dud.
Statistical arbitrage in stocks was a classic strategy. Then it was fairly straightforward. You pick a pair of stocks that are relatively similar, like Tesco's and Sainsbury's or something. And if Tesco's goes up by more than Sainsbury's, you short Tesco's and buy Sainsbury's in the understanding that these things move back together over time. And that's a classic example of a well-understood strategy that the more money goes into it, the less efficiency exists. At some point, it just disappears completely. And there are others like that, like the weekly reversion effect that happened that was fairly strong. And people kind of catch on to these things and the capital flows in and they stop working. So the market's full of these quirks and inefficiencies. And I was in that efficient markets mindset when I started. And I've spent 20 years becoming a bit less cynical about the whole thing.
Good to know we can still do stupid things in markets, even though we, in some areas, get a little bit smarter. One of my favorite signals that wasn't actually a real signal was somebody ran a natural language processing study on quarterly earnings calls and discovered that CEOs that said please and thank you more often had better subsequent stock price movement. But it only lasted for a few quarters. I quite like the idea that the market rewarded politeness, at least in theory. On research, in talking to quants, not to dismiss the research departments of other sort of conventional discretionary asset managers, but I don't feel their research teams are as embedded into the process or completely built into the process, as it often is in a quant manager. So what role does research play at Man, and what role do you as the CIO play at Man AHL, embedding it in?
Research is pretty central to everything we do. We run with a mindset that things slowly stop working. You need a very strong research team to keep finding an edge and maintaining an edge. And as I said, we're constantly building for the future. My view when it comes to research is that you need to empower people to work on things that they're interested in and that they think can have an impact. But on the flip side, they're accountable. So there's a freedom and accountability. These are all smart people. In order to get the most out of smart people, you need to give them that kind of intellectual freedom. Where I come in isn't so much to get involved in the details of everything, but more to just shepherd people towards areas where I think, look, if you do find something, the potential impact is very large, and therefore it's worth looking.
When we talk about culture, it gets a little bit hand-wavy at times, and everybody says they've got amazing culture and they're great at this. I am curious of what you think makes a good quantitative investment manager, because I assume it's not enough to shove a bunch of PhDs into a room and say, figure out something and we'll shoot the three people who come up with the three worst ideas. How do you get a lot of smart people that, yes, like freedom, it might be a little bit difficult and irascible at times, that the sum becomes greater than the individual parts?
You can equally look at the same problem in terms of a physics department, a university, or a pharmaceutical research lab, or anything where you've got a big group of people and they've got different specialities and different areas of expertise and different levels of experience. And you need to organize people in a way that the freshest, the ones with the least experience, are able to learn, and they're able to be in an environment that supports them, and they get to understand the full spectrum of what systematic trading involves. And you get the more experienced people who are motivated and productive and enjoying their job and feel like they're making a difference. We've tried to set it up in a way that teams themselves have got a really good sense of what they're trying to achieve, working in an environment where they can develop expertise, but they can also talk to people across a whole wide range of disciplines and have that sense of collaboration with people. I don't think there's one prescriptive solution to this. I would say the one commonality is that the individuals themselves feel that they can make a difference. Then it excites people and energizes them, and you get innovation as a result.
One fairly prominent quant felt people underestimated how much of his day was spent thinking about transaction costs and just improving execution. This is the boring stuff that nobody, no journalist, wants to talk about. But if you can shave a basis point off your transaction costs across the board, that's better than any signal pretty much you can discover in any given day. How important is this? Is it just for quant managers? Is it more important for quant managers? And how much time do you spend on this?
That bit of the process of systematic trading, typically you've got four areas, I think, of systematic trading. You've got the data bit that comes in. You've got the signal generation, the back of data. You've got the portfolio construction, which is turning signals into trades. And then you've got the execution bit. And we spend more time and capital and resource on that bit than anything else that we do. It's hugely important. The bigger you get, the more important it becomes and the more worthwhile it becomes to invest in that area. And it's not just about shaving off a basis point, although that is very important as well, because that scales. But it's also about information and using information. What you find is there's lots of information that exists on that layer where you interface with the market that provides lots of information. So for us to be able to feed back that information into our process and our order management and our signals, that can really make a big difference. It's always been important. For us, we'll go through a period of investing intensely, and then that all at the time seemed like, God, we're spending ages on it. It's taking years to see any results. Then you finally get there and it pays off for years. And then after a while, you'll think that the market's moved on again, so we need to invest again. And we're in that period at the moment of getting right down into the weeds. And as you say, spending more than our share of brain power and reserves and everything else on that bit.
So it's almost like a Stalin five-year plan. Every 5 years, you can upgrade everything.
Yeah, apart from the Stalin bit, I would hope. But
I see. You know, every organization needs its Stalin as well, I think, sometimes. Another thing that I hear a lot from every corner of the asset management industry it's a little bit deeper on the quant side, is risk management. I'm old enough to remember, you know, I have lots of friends in the industry. Risk management, they were essentially geeks that you told to go away because they were getting in the way of your P&L. That you had to work around them, essentially. And then after the crisis, of course, risk management and compliance were people you really had to listen to, but still essentially were impediments to you doing your job as well as you could. What role does it play at Man Group and specifically Man AHL?
It's as integral as it could possibly be. There was this whole discovery by Einstein that space and time were not these completely independent things. He's thought about space-time as a continuum. I don't think this is anywhere near as groundbreaking a discovery. But the idea that you can treat the two things as somehow independent, or that allowing you more risk allows you to make more return in an entirely linear way, is, in our view, just not correct. We run funds now and entire strategies that make zero return predictions, and all they do is risk management. And by doing that in a really sensible way, actually, you can turn that into additional returns. So we treat it as an integral part of the process, i.e. the models themselves have very clear signals and indicators that tell them about risk levels, and they take action appropriately. That's not to say that the risk management function itself doesn't still exist and doesn't still have this kind of independence check, which I think is important. As much as anything else, running a systematic trading strategy, that risk management bit, times can be at least as important, if not possibly even more important than for a discretionary trader, because they themselves, looking at their positions every day, should inherently have a sense of the risk that they're running. And what you at times can worry about with systematic strategies is that they encounter an environment they haven't seen before, and they encounter some price action that is just not in the boundary of experience. And at those times, it's useful to have an independent team saying, yes, but this could be a lot more extreme than we think. So to answer your question, I suppose, it's an integral part, but we still have that independent risk function.
Can you unpick a little bit this idea that risk management can be a source of returns as well?
There's a couple of things that you discover if you look at enough data. One of them is that the return levels of standard asset classes, by which I mean investable asset classes, which you expect to appreciate over time, the return levels don't tend to move around that much in the long run. And they're not really a function of how risky the market is either at any particular point in time. It is important on the general riskiness of the asset class. That does determine the expected return. But point in time, less so. So the idea that taking a fixed amount of exposure to an asset class equates to a fixed amount of risk through time, that just doesn't stand up. And the reason it doesn't is because risk as a property of markets is very predictable. It's persistent. If it's risky today, it's likely to be volatile tomorrow, and vice versa. Returns, on the other hand, don't show anything like the same degree of persistence or predictability. Once you establish those features of markets, not just volatility, but also correlation, which is another part of the risk equation. Once you establish those properties of markets, then you can change your assumptions about what an optimal portfolio should look like. And essentially what it does is it says holding a static amount of assets through time in the absence of expected returns isn't optimal. It's actually more optimal to adjust your position based on the riskiness, how correlated they are, how much volatility there is, etc. And that way you can extract more returns from the market for less tail risk. And that's the idea.
These are obviously pretty tumultuous times. I'd love to hear how, in general, you think quant strategies deal with market volatility uncertainty, particularly those kind of events that we just haven't come across before, whether it's the blow up of an inverse VIX-linked ETP in February 2018, or a pandemic, or a weird presidential election, or whatever it'll be. How do quant strategies handle that kind of stuff?
One thing that you find with stress events in the markets is next one will always be different. And we were saying that, of course, after COVID. And indeed, we're, you know, to be fair, living through a stressful period as we speak. And the impact on markets and the market ecosystem is always different and always unique. But the same kind of patterns tend to emerge. doing a good job of trying to cover as many bases as possible when it comes to those patterns. So the patterns tend to repeat themselves, i.e. markets get more volatile or relationships between markets change. And these things, they tend to do a very, very, very good job of picking up whatever market event rears its head. The point from a systematic trading perspective is to react in a sensible way, not necessarily try and be a hero in those situations and make a humongous return, but rather manage your position and exposure carefully. And that way, hopefully, able to experience the next risk event. So that's always kind of going from one to the next, but it's very much a part of how we think about things when we're building models and how we run the systems overall.
Is that when machine learning can play a role? That obviously it feeds on pre-existing data, but it can learn as new data comes in and it can adapt. Is that areas that you guys are deploying it?
It's not an angle that we've taken yet, but it's an angle that's quite interesting. We recognize with machine learning type strategies, they could be the most guilty about getting things wrong in a stress event because, you know, in their narrow-minded machine version of the world, assuming the world works in a certain way, something else happens and they get confused and then things start to go wrong. So we said, look, having experienced this, we never put a huge amount of capital, but we obviously learned through experience with ML type strategies. We started to build in all of these conditioning indicators, and that seems to really help. So it could be that the risk management is the next frontier for machine learning techniques. Could be. You heard it here first.
I remember talking to somebody who had spent quite a bit of time on this, and this was on a very high level. They said that if you train like a machine learning sort of system, that fundamentally what it learns is that medium-term trend following works and buy the effing dip, essentially.
We've seen the same thing. The machine learned to buy the effing dip until COVID came along.
Well, it's good. It's not just humans then. Machine learning obviously gets talked a lot about, but I'd love to hear your thoughts in closing. What you think the big next frontiers are for Quants Explore? If there's a human university graduate that hates quants but wants to become a discretionary manager, what areas of markets or finance should they go into to avoid becoming obsolete as a human being, as it were?
They tend to be, from our perspective, markets that become tradable for us in sufficient size and in a sufficiently fair way that we think we can trade in that marketplace and we can execute in that marketplace and create profits, net of costs, obviously. So a few areas have become more tradable for us in scale recently. So digital currencies, crypto has become one area that offers a range of things to trade. And it certainly offers lots of volatility, which is a good thing from our perspective. And then credit is the other area that there's a few more systematic players getting involved precisely because the market's becoming a bit more, a bit deeper, a bit more structured, a bit easier to interact with. And therefore, we can start running strategies and the cost yields are reasonable. As has been the case over the last 15 years at Man AHL, we're just looking for areas that have become tradable for quants. And even if no quants have done it before, we'll give it a go. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, on to the next thing. But that's been very much been our approach. As for the question about the young discretionary trader who wants to create a star name for himself and he doesn't want the quants invading his space, I always thought that merger arb was a good place for discretionary, insofar as you need to kind of really understand the structure of a deal and study the documentation and everything else. Having said that, with NLP and machine learning getting better by the day, really, I wouldn't rule it out for quant strategy. So having said that, as a young graduate, if you think it's all about trading in a discretionary way, we try and have an open approach to hiring at AHL. And it's not just mathematicians and physicists and those who play Dungeons and Dragons.
And they won't get picked on at Man AHL.
They won't get picked on. No, they'll be very welcome.
Well, that's good to know. Well, Russell, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. You know, despite the fantastic interruption of an alarm in the middle of the interview, but it's been great fun and hope to speak to you again soon.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Robin. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.